and welcome to One Inch Press Scary Podcast. This is Kirsty Saya, and it is February 18th, 2023. Holy cow. It's been some time. I actually thought that when last we spoke, it was the end of December, which still would be a significant chunk of time between episodes. But alas, when I went back and looked, it was actually December 5th when I recorded dutifully an entire episode and then failed to publish it. And I am certain that I deemed it unsuitable for publishing until I had edited it, which is why the whole editing concept for me needs to go away. It's just got to be a one and done. Like warts and all, interruptions, people knocking on the door like, yep, sorry, go away. We're not splicing things. This is not smooth. I'm not even using an external microphone anymore because mine died for some reason. I'm just like holding my phone here in my bed and trying to do this. I wanted to start on January 1st. I think I've already said that. I wanted to start on January 1st because I started grad school and I thought it would be really interesting for at least for me and Aaron, the only other person that I know consistently listens to this. I'm not sure if anybody else does, but that works for me. To have this sort of like, I don't know, an informal way of seeing how I progress in terms of my insights and the way I think about the world and how I as a human being have experienced grad school, if it's great, if it's terrible, you know, the bumps along the way, the little triumphs, all that stuff. I thought this would be very cool within this very curated experience of life. Because it's not necessarily often when you come to my age, you're doing things for a very defined length of time. This grad school program is supposedly, and I do say supposedly, for me, going to take 18 months because I chose, in all of my wisdom, the accelerator track. When I went to my immersion in January, the director of the program spoke affectionately of people like myself as crazy, those crazy people who choose the accelerator track. This did wonders, I might add, for my sense of security. Since I was very new to the program, and I still am very new to the program. But I'll tell you why I'm doing it, because I have the ADHD, which is only getting worse with time. And the thing about ADHD is that it often we're very much all or nothing kind of people. So if we're very fully immersed in something that captures our attention, we can hyper-focus on that thing and we can rockstar our way through it. It's when things get really drawn out and boring and commonplace that we start to lose the dopamine and there goes the interest and there goes the desire and it's a misery to get it done. And so knowing this about myself, I was like, wait, I've heard grad school is crap. So if it's going to be crap, let's have it like a short amount of all in crap rather than drawn out long crap, right? That's not bad rationale, really. That's not a bad rationale for something. I'm going to congratulate myself for that. Whether it turns out to be feasible for one such as myself, who apparently can't even record a podcast on anything close to a consistent basis, or does in fact record episodes quite frequently and then just leaves them in her drafts, remains to be seen. That definitely remains to be seen, as the last 7 weeks, I think, has just been the bridge. And that's been fairly hectic in different parts. At the moment, it's not very hectic. Thank goodness. It started out pretty hectic. And I really started to question whether or not I could handle anything more. And indeed, more is coming, because this is sort of the program that those of us who didn't get an undergraduate in psychology have to do. So we do basically a crash course on a wide range of things to sort of level the playing field between us and our fellow students who did get an undergraduate in psychology. Then we will get into the very nitty-gritty of actual grad school, which is when the accelerated program begins for me. At the very same time, I will be starting on my practicum, which is when I'll actually be counseling people under supervision at first. And that starts next month. So all of this remains to be seen, whether or not I can cope with accelerated. I hope so. But that remains to be seen. So I came into this thing with expectations, as we go into everything, with expectations of what I was going to really struggle with, knowing what I knew about myself and things that I anticipated would come very naturally to me. So let's start with, what was I sure I was going to struggle with? That is not going to be surprising to you when I tell you that it was organizational skills, time management. You know, we've just discussed the whole December 5th, never published the podcast thing. So you all know the girl, she struggles. Okay. And I've struggled mightily in recent years as less and less has been asked of me in order to keep within, like a schedule. Like I went from managing at my peak, at my prime of having to juggle balls, I had four little kids, age six and under, or maybe slightly older. No, age six and under, I was in, I was doing my undergraduate. I had church callings, which were really demanding. I had side hustles. I wrote a daily blog very faithfully that was monetized. I was doing a lot of things. And I think that, you know, that muscle, and I was younger, I was also really fit. I, you know, every single second of my life was spoken for, and I was sleep deprived, but I still managed to do it. And then I, you know, as time went on, dropped more and more and more of those things. Then came, yes, COVID, which basically just, not the actual disease, thank God, literally, but just that sort of like time has no meaning. For a couple of years when we just kind of burrowed underground and became pod people. Y'all remember that? Yeah. Well, I'm still recovering from that in a big, big way. And, you know, going from five kids and all their activities to one kid who has a far more sort of curated life than the others did at far fewer demands. And just being older, I was like, this is the perfect storm. The ADHD, all of it is the perfect storm. There is no way in hell I'm ever going to get an assignment in on time. I just don't know how that's going to work. Surprisingly enough, that came quickly. Now, I might well lose it again, so I don't want to be smug by any means or like assume that that battle has been remotely won. But I will say that I went from typing in the taskbar of my computer, how organized person time, what, to being able to get my assignments in a timely manner and find greater pockets of time to do other things within a few weeks. I did manage to sort of like hit my stride, find systems. And I'll tell you, one of the systems was highly sophisticated. It consists of colored sticky notes, post-it notes. And I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Dawn, who gave me, you know, like big ups on, this was something I kind of conceptualized. And then she really like, she confirmed that it's what I needed. And she knows, that I would need colored sticky notes and a whiteboard. And I managed to get this like little narrow whiteboard from Goodwill, which of course filled my heart with joy because you know I love the bargain. It's just like dopamine for me. So that carried me through to actually using it. And then this is very sophisticated. So get a pen and write it down if you want this organizational skill for yourself. I wrote at the top to do on it, right? Okay, you follow? Then in the middle, doing, right? And at the bottom, done. And then I added, is fun. And then I took what I needed to do on various color stickies that coordinated with the classes and the assignments. And then if I needed to do them, I put them in that area. And if I was doing them, I moved those stickies into the middle, right? You guys still following? Because I know it's hard to keep up with. And then when they were done, they all like clustered together in this very, very, very satisfying little bunch of sticky notes at the bottom of that whiteboard. And it was indeed fun. And that motivated me to keep doing those things. Astonishing, right? There's an actual name for that organizational system. I don't know what it is, but anyway, that worked out. So I went from how do thing to, okay, doing things reliably and consistently and actually getting them done with just some sticky notes and a whiteboard. If you too are in the what do thing nighttime phase, try that for a few weeks, see where it gets you. No promises, but for me, it was a lifesaver. So, you know, yes, those skills came, thank God, much more smoothly than I thought. My other big concern was, will I be triggered because of my background? I have, you know, recently sort of come out of intensive counseling, not very recently, but within the last few years, for complex PTSD, for some really severe trauma that happened throughout my life and then kind of was compounded by carrying that severe trauma healed into motherhood with a religion that really compounded the trauma and all that blah blah blah. If you don't know the story, it's not relevant to now, but I did have a lot to contend with in terms of triggers back in the day, and I am very much eyes wide open going into this because I have actually tried to do a master's in mental health counseling before, which I did put a stop to very early on because I was so triggered. And it's what got me the diagnosis of complex PTSD and all the treatment. So that was not for nothing. But I do know, you know, understandably, I went into this concerned about how the triggers would hit and how, you know, draining that was going to be to my mental health and what have you. So far, that has been manageable. And I know that I'm significantly stronger. And I can say that despite the fact that we haven't gone into anything very hairy at all so far, only because when I did meet a trigger that was very, very similar to a trauma that I myself experienced and very much sort of brought that back into the here and now viscerally and without warning, I went in, I would say, pretty impaired at that moment in time. Let me explain a little bit more. I had had a very bad experience in class. And what I assume happened is that RSD, which is a symptom of ADHD, it's called rejection sensitive dysphoria, kicked in very, very big and bad during that class. And I, at that moment, when the class ended, literally, if there was a deep hole, I would have jumped into it and just lived in it forever. I felt such acute shame, embarrassment, failure, and physical pain. So RSD actually is so much shame and pain, embarrassment, shame, from perceived rejection of any kind, that you feel it physically. So people will often clutch their chest if they describe it, or sort of writhe around in pain, or sort of like hunch over like they've been, you know, punched in the solar plexus. It's a really gnarly experience. And I hadn't experienced RSD for a long time. And I assume that I had been leading up to, you know, I'd been feeling little bits and little bits and little bits of it. And then I just got knocked with like a massive dose of it in that moment. So my response to that bad experience of a perceived rejection during class, it wasn't even rejection, but a perceived rejection during class, and shaming and everything, was, okay, I don't want to go out of my office space right now and deal with my family while I'm feeling so acutely bad. I don't want to see anybody. What I'm going to do is numb myself by just doing more work, just throwing myself into next week's assignment. And I went with that frame of mind. So I went with that like hormonal mess and walked directly into that trigger, into a really major trigger. And it wasn't fun. It took me a couple of days to regulate myself properly again. It wasn't an enjoyable experience, but it didn't set me spiraling. So that has given me a little bit more, or significantly more actually, confidence that I will be able to manage triggers as they come, because I don't expect to be walking into triggers at the absolute baseline of my coping capacities on the average day. And I know how to avoid that. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. What I wasn't expecting and have had to deal more with. Okay, so for one thing, I was very confident about my social skills. I am not a shy person. I'm not shy to present. I'm clearly not shy to do public speaking. I don't struggle to find things in common with other people and make conversation, even though I feel like I am pretty shy and I don't necessarily look forward to social interactions. And I am very much an introvert in terms of my energy levels, that while I enjoy going out and I do get fed by those experiences, they do take me a long time to recover from. So I also need a lot of downtime to recharge and just be alone. Like, I charge up by being alone. So I, that aside, the introversion aside, I was confident about my people skills. I was very confident about my social skills and about not feeling unliked, shall we say, or weird. I've never ex I forgot if I have experienced that, I've forgotten what it's like to feel like that. You know, the way that middle schoolers are depicted on TV as really shy and awkward, and they just imagine every single thing they do just being this dumbest thing, and that everybody's talking about them and everybody's judging them and they're the most embarrassing people. I experienced that. And not in my wildest dreams did I expect to be experiencing that in this particular setting. Because this, yeah, maybe if I'd gone out for a freaking, soccer team, like, college soccer team, of course, I would expect to feel dumb and out of place and not welcomed and not well liked and weird or othered. But not in a million zillion years did I go, wow, what if nobody likes me? What if I feel like a total idiot? That just, I mean, that's the beauty of being old, right? Like, I was like, oh, thank goodness I'm going, so I don't have to be afraid of looking dumb or being cool or any of that stuff. Like, I'm confident in myself and people kind of just get along with me and I get along with them. I'm not worried about that. The social part never even crossed my mind. And that was brutal. That was brutal. I didn't get how people were acting on Zoom at first. I was like, what the actual hell is wrong with these people's faces? Why is everybody staring like a bot? There's no like affect. Nobody's face was changing. And I was like, what is even happening right now? I was so confused by the lack of, what's the word? Emotion. People were not emoting. Oh, not in ways that I understood. They were just staring at the instructor. And I was like empathizing with how awkward I would feel if I were their instructor and not giving any facial cues. And so I'm taking this on as my responsibility and nodding like a freak. Like nodding frantically to try to like compensate for the fact that everybody else was just sitting back, relaxed, and taking in and absorbing the information she was giving. And so I'm like, I'm so stressed out by this. I am so stressed out by the fact that I'm carrying this whole class in trying to reassure the instructor that she is, that we're all alive, that we're all like taking in what she's saying. So of course, there's my boundaries creating a problem, like my very loose, leaky boundaries, thinking that for some reason I had to make up for the lack of like, emoting in everybody else. Well, that was my problem, nobody else's. Turns out the instructor is not, from what I can tell, was not at all put off or put out by the lack of emoting from other people. She didn't think it was weird. I even asked her. When I met her, I was like, so is it hard for you to just stare at people who are just, to talk and try and teach when people are just staring sort of owlishly back at you? And she was like, nah, you guys seem pretty like, interactive. And I was like, we do? Okay. So that part just blew my damn mind. And I felt instantly isolated and weird because I seem to be the only person affected by it. And I also, like my second class, I always assume everybody's having the same experience as me. So the first class, I was like, oh, this is weird. Everybody must be feeling the same way. So I will do them all a favor by bringing it up. So I come in and I'm like, hey, is anybody else like finding it weird to be on Zoom? And maybe if we all go off of our mics, like if we all unmute and it's just we can sort of like have natural interactions so that we, you know, we can hear each other laughing or we can hear affirmations or like, you know, murmurs of dissent, you know, stuff that happens in a real room. Should we do that? Like, would that help? And everybody looked at me like, okay, freak. And a couple of people were like, game for it. They were just being nice. From what I could tell, they were like, I don't care either way, but if it makes this old woman happy, that's fine. Now, I should also make it clear that I'm not like the only adult in her 40s in there. We are mostly coming from other professions, non-traditional students. There are people younger than me. There are people my age, possibly older. I don't know. So it's not like that. But I felt so entirely out of place. And I immediately just locked this away. Like, I'm not the same. And people aren't in sync with how I'm feeling. And I just got more and more. And so that rejection-sensitive dysphoria started just getting like tapped into, and I was feeling more and more unsure of myself socially for the first time ever, or for the first time in recent consciousness, because I am certain I felt like this many, many times as a child and as a teen. But it's something that I've really enjoyed not feeling in recent years. And then I realized something else. I've had the luxury, should I say, to curate people that are very similar to me in terms of my interactions in life. I have mostly done any work that I did was mostly from home or was with people with very similar interests in my own, like, hood. I haven't been wildly exposed to a great variety of people who don't see eye to eye with me on big things. And although we're all here for the same degree, there were people from all different parts of the country having so many different experiences. And I felt instantly super insecure and confused and just at a lost, sort of really just at a loss with how to deal with that. And that just shows that, you know, over COVID and the fact that we kind of were in our bubbles and then we curated our social media, I know I did, or it's self-curated. And my goodness, that was a very big, big sort of shock to the system. And not that I can tell that anybody has, you know, wildly out there differing opinions. No, like nobody's going in there being wildly opinionated. But it was just this totally new dynamic that I had not factored in. You know, everybody else is used to big groups in Zoom, whereas I was used to small groups in Zoom, and mostly that just being my friends, you know. Everybody else is used to people not emoting when it comes to computer sort of interaction. I'm used to, especially in these settings, I'm used to a lot, getting a lot of facial visual cues and that sort of thing. And finally, I am bigly into self-disclosure. And into, did you see I used the word bigly and I wasn't even being ironic and referring to Trump? Let's reverse, let's rewind and pretend I didn't do that, okay? Because that word must only be used in an ironic manner. Okay, I am majorly into self-disclosure, and that's been my work, you know, so to speak, you know. I have been a coach from a place of, I was vulnerable in this way, or I dealt with these same things. And, you know, just really kind of sharing my heart with people has been my norm. And I've become very comfortable with that because it's been accepted and wanted. And people have sought me out for that quality. And now I'm in a semi-professional setting where boundaries are a big deal. And self-disclosure needs to be taken Well, it needs to be done very conscientiously, very deliberately, and in a very measured way as a counselor. You certainly don't want to make it all about yourself, right? Which is another thing that as an ADHDer, we are prone to do. We make a story about ourselves in order to show somebody that we identify to their experience. And that is not received that way by a lot of people. They just think that we're taking their experience and making it about ourselves. And that's not what we're doing, but it comes across that way. But in terms of just being very comfortable with self-disclosure, in terms of being vulnerable with things that have happened to me, I have become so accustomed to doing that and thinking that I'm adding value when doing it. And I remember the first time I did that in class, I saw what I imagined to be like almost a visceral shrinking. Now, I'm sure that I have conjured in my mind a much more dramatic sort of reaction than what was there. Or maybe even entirely misread it. That is highly possible. I often do that. But that people were almost shaking their heads like, no, 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 we don't want to hear. We don't want to hear about you. We don't want to hear about your trauma. We don't want to hear. And I wasn't trying to go into any detail. I was just trying to add value. Like in my experience with PTSD, I had a counselor do this, and this was very helpful. It was sort of like the format. And it wasn't received in the same way that I'm accustomed to other people receiving it, because those people have sought me out for that reason for the most part. People who are within my circle online or who seek me out for my work or my writing, they want that. And here I'm in a group with people who are very conscious of boundaries when it comes to that. And have also, some of them, not experienced those things at all and haven't ever spoken to people who have, are just not nearly as conversant and comfortable with that being talked about as casually as I talk about it. So that felt so weird to me. And of course, I internalized that as a little bit more of the rejection. So the rejection sensitive dysphoria has probably been the most unexpected and trying part of this adventure so far. I feel like at this moment in time, I have a nice handle on it. That could change. That's the fucked up part about it, is that you don't really know when it's coming. This thing is not even that well dealt with talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. It actually takes a certain kind of medicine to tackle RSD. So I'm going to talk to my psychiatrist when I next see her about that medicine, about shutting off that little part of the brain that sort of just like leaps on any perceived slight or rejection or insecurity and just like makes it into a whole kind of life or death situation. Isn't that weird that it's actually something that they have to use a certain kind of medicine off label, by the way? It's something that they used to use unsuccessfully to manage blood pressure, and it probably won't be able to be prescribed for me because of the fact that I have POTS. So yikes, you know, so that's something that I did not expect I was going to deal with, and I dealt with very quickly from a lot of different directions. After this little break, I will tell you about the other big struggle that I had and the accompanying epiphany that has come with it. So come right back after this short break. Oh, and welcome to part two of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Grad School. Okay, so for this next part, I don't want to be accused of being cryptic. It is not my intention to be cryptic at all. But I think that what I want to say, that what I've learned is no way hinges on me telling the details of this story at all. And if you want to know the details of the story, feel free to text or, you know, ask me in some sort of private setting, and I'm happy to talk to you about it. It's just not something that I necessarily want to or should go into in a public podcast. Okay. So what I have learned, though, and it's something that really did set me up for a real epiphany this week with my therapist, and something that I know that I'm going to have to keep on working on maybe for the rest of my life, and maybe I hope that the accompanying epiphany will help somebody out there too, was that there are times when you're going to be asked to do something that's violating your own boundaries. And that can be ethical boundaries, or it could just be personal boundaries. It could be what you have decided, you're being asked to do something that you've decided would be a betrayal to your values, just your personal values, your sense of safety or comfort, your mental health, I don't know, your family time, your actual health, whatever, right? There are times, many, many times, over and over and over in our lives where we're going to be asked by others to violate those boundaries. And maybe that will happen in ways and in settings where you expect it to happen, you know, where you're kind of braced for it to happen. But it's often also going to happen at times when you least expect it and from people that you least expect it to happen with. And that's going to feel bad. And it's weird to me that I never stop being shocked when it does happen. Like, I never stop being hurt and like stunned when I feel like I've been asked to betray my boundaries in ways that seem like objectively bad. You know, like, it's not just a personal thing, it's an ethical issue that everybody should be able to see. I shouldn't have to do. And I think that I've been really naive in that way. And I need to just recognize that there are a lot of times where if people could serve both your and their interests, they would. But if it comes down to just serving their interests, they're going to choose theirs. And it's just something that I need to become accepting of and realize I too will not betray my interests, right? Okay, so that is the most clumsy way of leading into this. I don't know. I'm just not good at this. I'm not seamless when it comes to talking about delicate things. I'm such an open book that when I try to be like delicate, it comes so clunky. Anyway, I always get shocked and disappointed and sad. And then I start to second guess myself. Even if the thing I've been asked to do is objectively wrong and every trusted person I know is telling me, holy shit, I can't believe that anybody would ask you to do that thing. It's objectively wrong. Oh my hell. And I know it. They know it. We all know it. We're all talking about how shitty and like messed up it is and everything. And then I go ahead and I'm like, assert my boundary or reassert it and say, absolutely not. I will continue to feel bad about it. Right? And so for the longest time, since learning how to create boundaries, which is actually a whole nother story that took a ton of therapy to do, because I grew up in a home where boundaries were vilified when it came to me. I was not allowed them. And in fact, I was a bad person if I had them, and I was marginalized for having them. And I was taught throughout my life and throughout my adult life that boundaries were selfish and bad and wrong and blah, 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 and a betrayal and might actually sacrifice your eternal life with your family, right? So boundaries have been even the most fundamental boundaries, you know, your right to, you know, bodily autonomy and safety are like new to me as a way grown adult woman. So it's understandable that now that I am very, very clear on boundaries and I will not allow myself to be subject to betraying myself, especially if it's an objectively obvious betrayal, I still continue to feel bad when I upset other people because I will not betray myself. And I am upset with myself that I'm upset with myself. Does that make sense? Maybe not. Okay, let me put it a different way. All right. When I last spoke to my therapist, I said to her, the boundary that we discussed, that I was asked to violate, I did indeed not violate. I made it very clear I would not violate it. And when I declared that intention, I spent the rest of the weekend worried about how it would make me seem and if it would hurt people's feelings. And if it would hurt their feelings about me and how they saw me. And that makes me unhappy. I would like to be able to assert a boundary that is clearly within my interests. And even if people don't understand it, feel just fine. And I feel like if I was a whole and healthy person, I would be able to do that all the time and feel just fine about it. And she looked at me and laughed. Affectionately, she chuckled and said, hello, welcome to life. You do not have to pathologize everything, more or less, is what she said. I'm not going to like quote her verbatim because she didn't say anything that I'm going to say verbatim. But she said, basically, look, there are some things that, you know, and many times in which we don't care about upsetting other people. You know, we're not going to be upset about, you know, locking our door so that burglars cannot enter our house. That is a clear boundary. And we're not going to feel bad about the people who try the door with the intention of robbing us or violating our safety. Okay, there are some times that, you know, we feel nothing about it. We're healthy about it. We're cool with it. We don't give it a second thought. But there are so many other times when we will assert a boundary that we are completely crystal clear is right for us and our well-being, our safety, our emotional, professional, or physical safety, or mental health, or anything else that is not anybody else's business. And we will be crystal clear it's the right thing for us to do, and we will still be wracked by insecurity and bad feeling by how upset other people might be about it or how we seemed. And that doesn't make the boundary bad. And that also doesn't make us wrong. It just makes us human. And this was such a freaking epiphany for me because I have bought into the same freaking cultural lie that is when a woman does a badass thing and she stands up and speaks truth to power, which is something, by the way, that I'm actually really experienced in doing and have done far more than most other women that I know, with the stakes being insanely high. Like, I would lose literally everything I held dear, including my family, and have been willing to do that, right? So one would think I would have really, like, I'd only tell you all that, not to applaud myself, but to tell you that I've had experience in this regard before, and I'm still not there. I'm still not in this place where I understand that it doesn't feel good, and that doesn't mean that I'm not good. So I've done this quite a few times before, and I'm no better at feeling badass when I do it than I ever was before. We expect that there's going to be this movie soundtrack playing and this kind of go girl like song playing in the background. And like, you know, we're just going to hear in the back of our minds the roar of the crowds or the like the glow of satisfaction of being a strong, brave, independent, ethical, principled woman that doesn't give a damn, right? That we're just going to feel ourselves. That's not how it works in the real world, apparently. Maybe for some unicorns out there, it happens that way. But let me tell you, almost never does it happen that way for me. And if it does happen in the moment, and sometimes it does, sometimes I get a rush of courage and I'll do the damn thing and I'll be damn proud of myself. And then comes a sneaky second guessing. Maybe I'm the crazy one. Because after all, I was told I was the crazy one. I was set up to be the marginalized one to protect my abuser. He arranged that, right? And he arranged it that my family, the people closest and safest in my own mind, did that to me. So of course, and like so many other women, my story is in no way unique. I'm going to start second guessing, am I the crazy one? Am I in the wrong? Am I doing wrong? Because I'm becoming problematic and making things inconvenient for other people. All that stuff, right? It would creep in. So even if I do feel like a badass, and I will admit I felt that way a couple of times for a brief shining moment, and it's been glorious, absolutely freaking glorious, as it should, right? To do something brave should feel good. We mustn't buy into the lie that it's always going to feel good. We also mustn't buy into the lie that we're going to be supported by others. There will be times where we will do the absolute right thing for ourselves, and there won't be another soul in our circle who will see it that way. Maybe they just don't get it, right? Maybe they just cannot get it because they haven't lived it and they don't know what's going on inside your mind and the cost that it will take. You know, the price you will have to pay because of the thing that nobody else can see, because they wouldn't do the same thing and they would pay no personal price for it. Or maybe they can totally see why you should do the thing, but why it's incredibly dangerous and they don't want you to do the thing because they love you. And they're like, listen, is it worth it? Is it really worth it? Can you just go with the flow? How many people will really be hurt if you just go with the flow? Tell the lie, do the unethical thing. In the end, save yourself, because this is a crummy ass world and every fucking person out there is in it for themselves. And so you should too, because I love you and I want to protect you. I've been that same person. I've been the person telling people to save themselves. Sometimes maybe that is the right thing. I don't know, man. I'm not here to be the ethics police. Trust me, I haven't even had my course in ethics yet. I'm just going to say that there are times when you will do what you absolutely know is right for you, and you will have to do it or pay the price. And it will be a very high price for you to pay personally within your own soul. And other people just won't see it that way, and they won't support you. And you will feel like crap. You will second guess and you will wonder if you've got a background like mine, especially, and so many women and men too do, sadly, tragically, that they haven't learned or they were taught very early on to not to trust their inner voice or their inner knowing. That's going to happen, and it's not going to mean that you were doing the wrong thing. And upsetting other people will always feel upsetting for people who are basically inclined to get along. And you can call them people pleasers, and maybe sometimes they are. Maybe sometimes it's a pathological desire to please, and it's something that you do need to work on. We all do to some extent. But there are other times where just not being a sociopath makes it distressing to upset and inconvenience other people because you are determined to uphold a barrier for yourself or a boundary for yourself. That is also true. And that is something I need constant reminding, and not to then go and harm yourself in a secondary way because you're upset with yourself that you're second guessing or that you're overthinking. By the way, let's talk about the word overthinking. Somebody in my class in my recent class said, the professor said, please don't overthink this, you guys. Please just don't overthink this assignment. It's not a big deal. Just do it. And somebody else piped up, aren't we mental health professionals? Aren't we training to do this because we are inherently overthinking kind of people? And we all laughed and we laughed in grand recognition because, yes, there's a certain type of people who are wired with more empathy and are more curious about the workings and of other people's minds and the behaviors of human beings, who are more tuned in and tapped into the human experience and curious about it than others. And we have labeled ourselves, or others have labeled us, as overthinking. And can I just tell you, I hate that word. While I chuckled along with recognition, I hate being labeled an overthinker. It might be true. If there was some kind of like ratio of what kind of thinking is enough thinking, right? But what the hell? Can we just get that word out of our lexicon? Because what do you mean overthinking? Like, when is it enough? When is enough thinking enough? Yes, obsessing and perseverating. Persuading? Am I saying that word right? I've only seen it written. I don't think I've ever actually said it. And, you know, that kind of stuff. When you're going round and round, ruminating. All those things are distressing, right? But there's thinking that leads to insights. There's thinking that leads to epiphanies. You know, the type of thinking that maybe begins with ruminating, the type of thinking that you take to your therapist and you talk about, the type of thinking that you maybe apply an analogy to and you see an answer from nature or from something else you've experienced and compare. And then, as what happened to me recently, I took something that I'd worked through in my mind carefully and I shared it, like literally as a vulnerable gift to a usually very compassionate Facebook sort of demographic, right? And a couple of people very kindly said, wow, aren't you the little overthinker, or something to that effect. And I was like, damn, here I am, like expressing how I worked through something that was really hard for me. And honestly, I don't even remember what it was, but I do remember people dismissing all that hard work that I put into figuring something out and exactly how I did it, thinking that I was offering this great gift. And I'm sure it was a great gift to some people. And then a couple of people just saying, wow, overthink much, and not in a malicious way. They're not malicious people, but I took that really hard because I was like, wow, I'm sharing a vulnerable part of me, and I don't like the idea that working through emotions and figuring things out, I don't like people dismissing that as overthinking. I think that is very unhealthy. I think that is an unhealthy part of our society where it's like if something doesn't come very easy and surface level and you're not able to work it out right there and then and become very, very comfortable, I dub thee an overthinker. Stop that right now. We don't like that. And nor should you. Overthinking leads to breakthroughs. And yeah, maybe it takes a lot of discomfort first. Maybe it takes an enormous amount of rumination and pain because of the rumination. But if I hadn't have so-called overthunk the fact that I was unhappy about how I obsessed all weekend, about how I didn't want to upset a particular person when I asserted my boundary and where my head was on that, because she was a nice, pleasant person who has never done anything but try to help me, but she also was in a position to take that information to other people who really didn't give a damn about me. If I hadn't have taken how upset I was over that and all those ruminations to my therapist, she couldn't have given me this wonderful insight, which is, hey, it's always going to feel shitty, but that doesn't mean you're shitty, baby, right? That was gold to me. I could take that little nugget away and cherish it and share it with other so-called overthinkers or people who are brave and principled, but also don't like to upset and inconvenience others. Those two things can coexist and often do. And we've got to recognize that there is space and hold that space and reassure each other that that's normal, that you're not always going to feel triumphant and badass when you do badass things. You're going to feel fucking terrible and insecure and second guess yourself over and over again and ruminate. And then eventually let it go. Oh, maybe if you're lucky, you could take it to therapy and they'll help you let it go. But at least you will not have betrayed yourself, because that is the ultimate worst. When we betray ourselves to keep the peace, it is not our peace that we're keeping. It is the peace of other people. We have boundaries for a reason. And we have ethics for a reason, and we have principles for a reason, because we know that our highest self thrives within those. Our highest and healthiest self thrives within those parameters. And when we try to violate those things to keep other people happy with the mistaken assumption that it will keep us happy in turn, because we won't have to worry about what they're thinking about us and blah, 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 we will always come unstuck in a big bad way. Maybe not immediately, but eventually it catches up to us. And then in my experience, things come tumbling down big time. And that's when you start to really do things that will make people wonder about you in ways that you don't want them to wonder about you. You know, if you do things, if you cave and do things that are not in keeping with your own ethics and principles and morals or your own boundaries, and eventually it catches up to you, and then you are aware of people thinking badly about you, there's no comfort to be found at that point, because you didn't do the right thing by yourself and possibly others. And there is hollow, hollow comfort in there. So yeah, that's my little pep talk for the day. There is not going to be the, like, you know, who sings that, you know, who is it? The one is like, oh my gosh, Sarah somebody, not Sarah McLachlan, the other one. This is where I sound so old and my kids are like, please, 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 please just stop. It's fine if you don't know the name of the person, just shut up. But the one I know, as soon as I'm done, who sings like, be brave, you know, I want to hear your words. The one who sings, Sarah Barry Ellis, my God. I hope that made everybody else having their senior moment feel so much better. Thank you. I only live to serve. Sarah Bareilles. You're not going to hear her like in the back of your mind when you're overthinking this in the night and worrying that you upset somebody or that people are going to think you're crazy or high maintenance or a problem. It's going to feel bad. And that's just a fact of life, man. That's the fact of living in a flawed world. But eventually you'll get over it and you'll be glad that you did what you did. So that's what I learned from grad school, or I relearned, because I've been learning that for a really long time. But I needed to relearn the piece that it's okay. It's okay to ruminate over it, and it's okay to worry about offending people, because it's human. It's how packs stay alive. We assign alphas, you know, social animals. We assign conformity for a reason, right? Loosely, going back to tribal times. And, you know, if you think of us as social animals, just like any other animal, we have to do certain things. We have to conform in certain ways. And we feel more comfortable when we're making authority happy. Are we not? For most part, yeah. I claim to hate authority. I claim to rail against authority, but there are plenty of times where I want nothing more than the people in authority to just like me or not notice me at all. Like, how many of us are just like very, very happy about upsetting the police or having an arrest warrant out? We're not. We don't like it, right? There are reasons for that. So we are wired not to like confrontation, not to like the feeling of being nonconforming, not to like the feeling of not pleasing people. And that's okay. That's okay. If everybody felt totally fine about not pleasing people, we would all be sociopaths. So, you know, it is what it is. If you're a highly socially conscientious person, having boundaries and enacting them is often going to be very, very, very uncomfortable. And that's my pep talk for myself and for you today. If you were thinking about going to grad school as an older adult, say, you know, in your 30s, 40s or beyond, but you were just like, nah, because, I don't know, any reason, just do it, man. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why in my great amount of knowledge from 6 weeks in this experience. Actually, I've had other experiences in grad school. Like, why not, man? Why not? Like, experience it. Discover if it's for you or not. Instead of wondering. Because if the idea came into your mind and it's something that seems intriguing and it keeps coming back to you and you don't do it, what are you gaining? Maybe you do it and it's a lot easier or more fun, or it's terribly, terribly hard, but the challenge scratches an itch for you that you thought was long, like, unscratchable, and part of you comes alive again and it's fascinating and wonderful. Or your depth of knowledge and your maturity is exactly what somebody else there needs. Maybe somebody of your exact same age. Maybe somebody much younger. Like, don't put it off. Life is shockingly short and very unpredictable. So if it's something that you have even a moderate desire to do, go for it. You'll soon enough know if it's not for you. Give it a semester or two. You can always bail. Do it. It's expensive, though. That's the one thing. Man, it's expensive. But, okay, from the stance that I am in now, the place I'm in, I'm glad I'm in it. I'm glad I'm doing it. Did I want to quit, like, daily, thrice daily for the first few weeks? Yes. Am I anticipating that being the case moving forward 6 to 8 times daily or more? Yes, very much so. Am I becoming much better with sitting with that urge and actually not running and hiding? Yes, and that's the best part that's come from it. My ability to stick with very, very uncomfortable things is growing again, and with it, my sense of confidence. So going, okay, I want to quit, but I'm not going to quit just yet. I'm going to finish out this homework assignment, see how I feel after that. I'm going to feel maybe better when I wake up in the morning and I'll think about quitting then. On a Friday afternoon, when I think I'm going to quit, I'm going to give it till Monday, and on Monday I'm going to give it to Friday. I'm always going to kick that can down the road, and if it's like kicked enough times, I guess I'll know. But each time I've had a like, nah, I can do this. The other thing I did when I first wanted to quit, and I was like, I am entirely unsuited for this. It will be absolutely the worst thing that could ever happen to me, is that I pictured myself that, you know, the next time class was on, not logging into class, not seeing the people on Zoom, not getting engaged in the work, and doing something else instead. And I gauged how that made me feel. And that is why I persisted, because not doing it felt worse. And not because of my ego, because I don't have a lot of ego in this grad school experiment, thankfully, because that would set me up for a disaster. I'm like, C's get degrees, girl, right here. You know, I'm just like, I'm just, you know, I'm really honored to be nominated kind of thing. But what I would say is that I just want to feel good, and I want to feel engaged in life. And when I pictured how I would feel on that Tuesday afternoon doing something else rather than that, it felt like I was losing my sense of purpose. And that's why I knew I had to do it, no matter how ill-suited and uncomfortable I felt in that role at the time. And that got me through another week. And that's what I'm going to keep doing until, when I imagine not logging on, it feels a lot better. And it feels like that will be my purpose. And it will be better suited to my soul's purpose. And then I'll do that thing. But right now, my soul answered, no, anything else you'd be doing would not be in keeping with what you know your purpose is. So just do this for one more week and see how it goes. And that's how I'm taking it. Literally 1 week, sometimes one homework assignment at a time. Literally just a homework assignment at a time. It has been touch and go a lot of times. It has not been a traditionally difficult grad school startup. It has been that. It's been difficult, and then some, with some very, very wacky layers that nobody could have predicted and are almost comically weird and exquisitely designed to be triggering to me. But, you know, I would still say go for it and talk to me next week. Maybe I'll log in next week. Maybe I'll actually get it right to do this weekly, and you'll see me rant about how I just quit grad school, and then you'll know. I don't know, man, but I am in it for this week. So let's see how it goes. Thank you for tuning in. I hope some little nugget was of value, or entertainment value at least. And I do very, very much hope to be more regular with this. ADHD goddesses allowing, I will be, because I think this will be useful for me, or at least entertaining to look back on. Thanks again, and have a great week. Remember, doing the right thing doesn't always feel comfy, almost never does. And we only really ever have to hang in anything for 60 seconds or a breath at a time, and then we can decide again after that. Take care. Darlings, love you. Bye.